Hello, this is Chris Robinson, writer and producer of the Forbidden Diary audio drama. In episode 18, Natalie wrote about a letter she received from a friend in a civilian prison camp in Manila that gave a glimpse of internment life in other camps. In this epilogue, you'll get an even greater glimpse of what life was like in other camps, as it is a continuation of an interview with Kurt Brooks, who was interned with his family in Manila at a civilian prison camp called Santo Tomas. You can hear the first part of Kurt's interview in the Episode 6 epilogue in Season 1, 1941, where Kurt talks about the pre-war years, December 8, and events leading up to internment. In this second part, Kurt talks about his life in a Manila prison camp. As you may recall, Kurt and his family were interned in Santo Tomas for the entire war. He was interned from age 13 to 16. Kurt is now 96 years old. Let's pick up where we left off. Kurt, what were the first few weeks of internment like? I know with Natalie, those were the roughest weeks. What was it like in Santo Tomas?
I know that there were no beds or anything. We just lay on the floor for sleeping, and they had a kitchen going. But we more or less lived off what we'd brought with us, as I recall.
You must have brought more than 3 days if you were living off of what you...
Yeah, right. Well, it was a package line that formed early on. The Japanese didn't mind that. They inspected the packages, of course, but we could get food from friends and neighbors, Filipinos, who came to help us out in that respect. And... quite a bit of stuff went through the package line, and the package line stayed in existence at Santo Tomas until February of 1944. So it was an adjunct that was quite important to our well-being throughout.
So a package line was the ability for people from the outside to give you packages and let them be brought into the prison.
Yeah, that's right. It was brought in, and the Japanese brought the packages to an area where the internees could pick them up. And
how many people were you interned with in Santo Tomas?
Well, the number given at the time of liberation was 3,700. And,
did that number fluctuate while you were there? I know. In Baguio, people kind of came in and out. You know, they'd have missionaries coming in. They'd bring in people from who had run into the hills, and then they were captured. They were interned with Chinese in the beginning.
Well, yes. In fact, the Chinese, as far as I know, were largely left to themselves because they were important business people in Manila. I think a theme of the Japanese occupation could be described in one word. They were looking for normalcy. They wanted the Philippines to be a normal colony of Japan, where the people accepted the Japanese and lived as a prosperous community in the hegemony of Japan. And an important part of that prosperity, so to speak, was the Chinese business community. So you're going back a long ways in my memory, but I don't recall our hearing much of hostility toward the Chinese community by the Japanese. But the Filipinos never changed.
No, they didn't. Well, it was their country. They were hoping to get it back in 46.
There was a story going around that supposedly, and I don't know if it was true or not, they said when the Spanish came, they called us Carabaos. When the Americans came, they called us monkeys. But then the worst thing of all was when the Japanese came, they called us brothers. Speaks volumes.
Who were you interned with? In Baguio was a pretty homogeneous group, but They kept carrying word back that Manila prisons ran the gamut from company presidents to road workers to ladies of the evening. Was that that the case, or was it not?
Well, sweeping up all the Americans in the American community in Manila, you got a real mix of people. There were lawyers and doctors and executives and business people. And then there were those who had come over in the 1898, in the Filipino-American Wars, they called it, the Philippine Insurrection, we called it. And they stayed. They married a local girl and raised families and stayed. So you had people who were tied to the local community through their families. And on the other hand, there were people from Shanghai and China who got caught in Manila, and their ship stopped in Manila when the war broke. And of course, the Japanese were bombing ships, so they put all these people ashore. And I say the British community was quite large in Manila, and two of my very close friends were Australian, John Curdo, David Lation. But both those boys were sent to Australia for their higher education and were not interned. You had Catholic priests, for example, and some missionaries and that aspect of it. And so there was quite a mix. And the advantage of that was that the Japanese largely left governing the camp to the camp itself. And we had leaders elected, more or less, the Central Committee. And, of course, they were very much under the thumb of the Japanese authorities, but a lot of the routine decisions were made by the internees themselves, how the gardens were run and that sort of thing.
Were men and women allowed to live together? What was the living situation like?
Well,
how did people, families
yeah,
live?
At first, we didn't have shanties, and there was complete segregation. My brother and I were first interned. We were in the gym, and there were 700 men in the gym and four toilets. You can imagine the circus. But later, we were able to build shacks and shanties, get the material through the gate, and and we built a shanty, and when those were built, and there were a lot of them all over the grounds of the camp, when those were built, I think there were, in some cases, married couples could live together, and my parents never did that. In fact, our shanty was small enough so that if somebody slept in it, there was no room for anybody else, and we had our meals there, and so we were at the shanty quite a bit of time. And my brother and I, they had a school. It was run by the camp, and that was one of the first things they did, was set up a school for the kids. They realized that we were going to be in there for the long haul, and they set up a school, and the mix of professions in the camp. There were a lot of educators. Mrs. Croft, our principal, was very prominent in that. And my last year in Santo Tomas, my junior year in high school, we had four different or five different teachers. They were all Catholic priests. They were had been sent to the Philippines to set up schools in Mindanao and elsewhere, and then they were interned. So there was enough variety there. One of the classes I took was taught by an engineer, and he didn't have much training in teaching, but he knew his math, and I think did quite well.
Where and how did you get food? Was it provided at camp? I know you said that people on the outside were allowed to bring in packages. Was that your only source of food? Or was it provided by the camp or the Japanese?
The camp was given money by the Japanese to buy food on the local market. And Yes, for the first 2 years, it was it certainly wasn't elegant, but it was. I tread lightly on this, but I think let's say it was satisfactory, if not satisfactory, satisfying. And they had the central kitchen, which served the meals. And we all had the little cards that were punched each day so that you couldn't stand in line twice. And I say for the first 2 years, the camp kitchens were supplied by having buyers go out on the local market and buy the rice and the vegetables and dogs and cats. No, I kid me. But I think some of that got in mixed in with it.
And then people were allowed to use their own money to get extras.
Yeah, we got through the package line, and also there were gardens in the camp where vegetables were raised, and quite extensive gardens. And so the first 2 years, there was a routine of getting enough food. A meal was usually rice mush, but that was fine. I still like it. And, of course, that all stopped in February. The package line stopped and the buying stopped. The Japanese then provided the food from their own stocks.
Why did that happen?
Ask the Japanese.
maybe they were worried about espionage and information going in and out because they were...
No, to some extent, perhaps they did. But I think our treatment was a reflection of the events of the war itself. By February of 44, it was clear the Americans were on the march and were headed for the Philippines. And they were tightening the belt, so to speak.
So the Japanese were supplying the food. You weren't purchasing it. You were not allowed to have packages coming in. How soon did you start to feel the effects of not having enough food?
Well, right away, the food the Japanese supplied was inadequate. And we began to feel the effects of that almost immediately, as I recall. And in time, it got to be less and less. And it wasn't too long before it was totally inadequate. And you got up hungry. You sat down to meals hungry. You got up from meals hungry. You went to bed hungry. It was pervasive and corrosive. There was no relief from that. You knew that was going to be your existence until liberation came. And the memory of that all-time hunger has stayed with me ever since. And another aspect of that was that it was inadequate as far as vitamins go. We all had beriberi to some extent, the lack of vitamin B, and I can remember my brother and I both had the symptoms of beriberi, a fluid collection in your system, and I used to have to get up 6 or 7 times a night to use the toilet, and when you do that that often, you don't sleep much.
Was there a medical staff, or did you have access to hospitals? What was that like?
There was a Santa Catalina hospital, and it was quite extensive, and it was well staffed.
Did you have doctors at the camp, doctors who were interned?
Yeah. They had, the Manila community had its Dr. Fletcher and Dr. Leach, but the military were brought into the camp as well. One of them was a dentist, I think, but the other two were GPs. And we, of course, had the Army nurses from Bataan were interned with us, and they helped staff the hospital. And for a while, anyway, the contingent of Navy nurses that were also picked up in Corregidor, and But I think they all went down to Los Baños. I'm not sure. But the army nurses stayed with us.
Well, that was a blessing. In Baguio, the camp struggled with waves of dysentery epidemics. Did that plague Santo Tomas too?
Oh, yes. It was quite a death rate, and particularly from the older internees, like those who had gone there in 1898. There was a lot of illness, and towards the end, beriberi was very prevalent. In effect, that essentially that's what my dad died of. We had measles in camp, which went all over. There was dengue fever. I had dengue fever twice, both times in the camp.
Did they have access to sulfamez? They didn't have penicillin back then, but they did you have access to medications for that?
For dengue fever? No.
Yeah, or for any, you know, major illnesses.
Oh, some of that came, I think, sulfur drugs came in the relief supplies. We got what we called comfort kits, but they were food packages from the States. In fact, we got three installments of food packages. The first was from South Africans. Why we got them, I don't know. I have no idea, but they... And there was one package for two people, I think.
What was in them?
Yeah, canned food. The second installment came from the Canadians. That, again, I think was one for every two internees. And then we got the packages from the American Red Cross. They were a part of the shipment that came with the exchange of prisoners that went on in the fall of 43, and the American Red Cross packages were very useful, and I should mention probably saved lives, because they, again, it was canned food, and it was a happy supplement to what we got on the food line.
And that was December 43, I think?
Probably November of 43, yeah. They had clothing that came with it, and some dresses for the women. And I got a pair of shoes from the American Red Cross that had come from the States to Goa in India, and from Goa in India to Manila, change hand, and so on. And these shoes had cardboard soles. They didn't last a week. Why bother with sending that stuff if it was useless? But that's what I got, and that's what they were. They had a thin strip of leather on the bottom, and then the rest was cardboard. And sort of resolved that we would take this up with the Red Cross and find out what happened on that, but they never did. We had other fish to fry.
I bet you did. What are your recollections of the guards and the commandants that were at Santo Tomas? Are there any that come to mind?
Yes. We were not allowed to watch the air raids. This was in late 44, I think December. And we were supposed to stay away from windows. Well, one afternoon, there was a group of us watching American planes bombing and strafing Grace Park, the airfield north of us. Somebody came by and said, "The Japs coming." And sure enough, one of the soldiers was coming along. And for some reason, he picked out me. And for 5 minutes, I looked down the barrel of a rifle. And while this Japanese harangued me, in the good course of Japanese, I understood not a word about it. But it was a moment.
Wow. How old were you?
I was 13. No, I'm sorry, I was 16. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln liked the play. Most of us had relatively little to do with the guards. Of course, they had roll call twice a day. And you had to get in front of your room and get counted. And most of the time, that was done by the room monitor, and the report was turned in. The number of people were always reported. But from time to time, the Japanese would conduct the inspection. And of course, bow to the Japanese, and they counted us. But that wasn't very common, and it wasn't very onerous.
Was anyone interrogated by the Kempei Tai? Was anyone caught for espionage, or did someone try to escape?
Yes, I think from time to time, but the most prominent of that was the four leaders of the camp were arrested in December of 44 and then taken out of camp and later executed.
Oh, my. Were people used as examples, tortured in front of prisoners? Did you see that?
The worst thing that I saw was they brought in a Filipino from outside, and they beat the living daylights out of him.
Mm.
They just beat him till and that was at the front gate. A group of us had going by, and that was a terrible sight.
Oh, I would imagine.
Now, but that was a Filipino from outside that.
But nothing in your internment camp. You didn't see that, luckily.
We didn't. I don't recall any other real. Of course, early on, the three British sailors escaped from the camp and wound up in a bar somewhere, and were picked up, and again were beaten to a pulp and then executed. Oh, no, that happened at camp. Well, they took them out to a cemetery and had the graves dug, and bang. And that was witnessed by several of the internees that were brought by the... That was intentional. That was a case where they wanted us to understand that if we escaped, there was not much hope. The consequences were severe. What a pity. The guys didn't think much of it because it was easy to escape. But then finally, about 3 weeks before liberation, a strange character, Eisenberg, I think his name was, who was a kind of a newspaper man, but he disappeared, and the Japanese fussed about it. But I was surprised that their reaction was rather mild over this escape, and it has been suggested in some other quarters that perhaps he escaped with the connivance of the Japanese. Why that was so, I don't know, and I say that was a strange business. He was in the gym, and there was apparently a way to get over the wall there, and he did. But that was about 3 weeks before liberation, and one could imagine that the Japanese had other things on their mind with the American army approaching from the north.
Well, we're going to get into that in the next interview. While you were interned, what were you most fearful of?
There was sometimes a sense of despair. How is this going to work out? And going back to what I said, the pervasive sense was one of hunger, pervasive hunger, and that stayed with you all the time.
Probably stayed with you all your life. What about boredom? Sometimes that's even worse. You know, you got all this time on your hand. Did you have routines and stuff that kind of helped you to mentally shift your mind into other directions?
Of course, we had school and we had homework and we had jobs and we had work as well. And I don't recall too much dead time. We had our sports and we organized everything ourselves. And that in itself was a challenge, but it kept you busy. I mean, we had a kind of a little softball league. They had a softball field for us in the front of the camp. And we used to use that quite a bit. And
that kind of dovetails into my last question for this segment. It was a rough experience that you had, but was there anything you remember with fondness of your time being interned?
A good question. What we had was tight friendships that we made. We shared rumors and stories and sports and so on. You know, we were kids and we did not share the kind of despair that some of the adults had. They had lost their jobs, their careers, and their homes and their possessions. But we could not tell what the future was going to bring. And I can remember thinking that how was this all going to end? But I didn't.
You were a kid. You think differently. You know, you weren't worrying about your kids and what was going to happen to them.
We weren't worried about the big picture. Let's put it that way. Yeah. In that sense, there was this advantage is that you had your friends every day, you know, and all day, so that you weren't bored for that reason.
Well, thank you so much for giving listeners an intimate view of this little-known chapter of World War II in the Pacific and what it was like to be a civilian prisoner of war. I'm going to be talking with Kurt at the end of season 5, 1945, to find out what happened to him at the end of the war and to get his thoughts about how this experience affected his life. Kurt, thank you so very much for talking with me.
You're quite welcome.
And thank you all for listening in. We'll see you in 1945.
Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.